We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 55. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'll be your host today. And today we are talking about redefining tribal archaeology. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute Peoples Treaty Lands, the Dene'ta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. So today we have Dr. Martina Dolly on the show. Dr. Martina Dolly is the senior archaeologist with the Hualapai Nation's Department of Cultural Resources in Peach Springs, Arizona. Her responsibilities include preserving and managing the cultural resources of the Hualapai people while adhering to standards established by the Tribal Historic Preservation Office, the Hualapai Cultural Resources Ordinance, and the Secretary of the Interior Standards. Dr. Dolly received her bachelor's in 2006 in anthropology with a focus on Southwest archaeology, and her master's in 2009 and doctorate in 2013 in American Indian Studies from my alma mater, the University of Arizona, with a focus on caring for ancestral remains and their belongings as it relates to repatriation and heritage preservation. So welcome to the show, Martina.
Yay. Hi.
Well, I am so excited to have you. As I mentioned before we got on the call, I have a giant list of questions to ask you, and we are definitely not going to get to them all, but I'm excited to the fun conversation that we do get to. So thanks again for coming on the show.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right. So to start us off, how did you get interested in this kind of work?
Well, I think like most people who get into this field, I kind of just stumbled into it. It started way back in the 80s. I did a little bit of contract archaeology during that time period and then worked for the Park Service for a little bit, became a little bit more interested, and then decided, you know, what the heck, go to school and earn that extra dollar as a field archaeologist. And so that's pretty much how it went. And what interested me was, number one, you know, these are the people that we were, I guess, for lack of a better term, you know, digging up our ancestors. You know, they're people that are from, you know, my heritage. I'm, you know, Navajo, and I'm also Hualapai, or, you know, Dene, not Navajo, but anyway. Yeah, I mean, it was just really like interesting to see. And then I think what interested me was actually watching the way the archaeologists behaved when they found or they were digging up the ancestors and what really interested them. So that made me curious too, because it just seemed so weird at the time, but also interesting. And then once I got into the field, it was like super like exciting. And, you know, I was really excited to excavate and to do research. And then I took my first American Indian Studies class. And then that put me into a different path looking at cultural heritage. So yeah, so that's, you know, what led me to this profession.
So, okay, I'm curious because I feel like a lot of people don't even run into CRM until, you know, they have discovered anthropology, and people don't necessarily even discover anthropology right away. So how did you get connected so early with CRM work? Could you talk a little bit more? Because I know we have some listeners that are really interested in hearing about CRM work. Could you talk a little bit more about what that work was like for you?
Well, this is kind of a goofy story. I was going to school at a community college at Pima. I was majoring in art and, you know, working on the school newspaper they had there. I was actually the photo editor there. And I took a class illustrating artifacts. And that was really interesting. And at the time, you know, the guy that I was actually seeing and also like living with was at the university studying anthropology. The woman who was my instructor, her husband was one of the project directors for a company called Pueblo Archaeology that was owned by Al Dart. And just, you know, out of the blue one day, they invited me out to do a survey out, you know, just probably a few miles east of Three Points down in the Tucson area.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting. Didn't really make a big deal out of it. Wasn't really like, you know, wow, this is awesome. It was just mostly, you know, going out there for the exercise and, you know, getting paid. My partner at the time, you know, he was studying anthropology, and I actually typed all his papers because we didn't have a computer and we didn't have a word processor. So I actually typed all his papers. I also edited all his papers. So I knew all the classes. And then the archaeology company started calling me out to come out and work with them. And I didn't realize it at the time, and it kind of pisses me off, but at the same time, it makes me laugh. You know, they needed that Native person on their site. So I happened to be that Native person. Mm-hmm. But being that I have a little bit of my mom in me who likes to be a little bit more in control, I got to the point where I was able to do my own paperwork and given my own test units. So somewhere out there, I have test units with my name on it and all the documentation. So yeah, I was doing the same thing as the paid archaeologists were, you know, the actual archaeologists who had degrees were doing. Mm-hmm. They just trained me, taught me how to look at a profile, how to, you know, dig down into one by one, how to do trenches, you know, identify artifacts and everything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those were my first experiences, and that was like back in the 80s. And, you know, again, you know, not really thinking too much about it. It's just that it was fun. It was outdoors and, you know, it was really great exercise and I stayed in shape. I finally just, you know, had to think of other resources and, you know, got a different job. And then, you know, just being away from it for a while and then coming back, you know, just because as a contract archaeologist, you're never just like, you know, a professional and you don't have insurance and you don't clock in. It's just kind of like, you know, there's a job coming up. It's about a month and you go and you get onto that job.
Right.
So that, you know, so that's pretty much what it was like. It was interesting. It was kind of eerie. I took a lot of photos of infant burials, some of the burials that were uncovered, especially down at, you know, Roosevelt Lake.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
It was kind of sad, but, you know, at the same time, you're like, okay, you know, just being really practical and desensitized about the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just again, back to watching and listening to the professionals, you know, how, you know, they really viewed our culture. And there was a major disconnect. It was like, I wasn't even connected to that. It was like, you know, there were these super natives from a long time ago. And then here I am a native, but I'm not right. That awesome, you know, but I'm good enough to be on the site so that they can check their box.
Oh, God.
And, you know, there I am. Yeah. So they can get their work done. Mm-hmm. That went on for a while. And I just, again, wasn't super interested until my parents came down to Tucson to visit me, and we were working at that Rancho Vistoso before it became that big old housing development. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of excited to show them where I was working, you know, so I took them out there. My dad was really hesitant. And then my mom was like, you know, she's very inquisitive. So she was like wanting to know everything. So I showed them around. I was explaining to them, you know, what this was a pit house. These are post holes. There's a hearth. There's a agave, you know, roasting pit, you know. So I was just telling them all about the culture and everything. And then when they were leaving, my mom took me aside and she said, "Don't ever tell anybody what you're doing."
Yeah.
And I was all like, "What?" Yeah. So what she meant was, you know, going home and being with other natives, she didn't want me to tell them what I was doing.
Right.
And, you know, and then she started doing, you know, blessings and, you know, really making sure that I was okay. So if I go home, you know, somebody will come out and we'll do like a little ceremony at the house. So that was her way of keeping me safe. And then we would talk about it here and there. And she said, you know, what you're doing is, you know, for a lot of the natives, it's not a good thing.
Right.
But you're actually doing something that's, you know, interesting. And she said, just talk to them. And I'm like, okay, you know, whatever that means. And then, you know, just going through that and thinking about what she said, you know, I think that really made me just like really feel interested in the whole thing. That didn't inspire me. That did not inspire me to go off to college to get my degree.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're going to laugh, but so the guy I was talking to you about, that was my partner. Uh-huh. I eventually ended up marrying him.
Okay.
Had a couple of kids. Not a good guy. Yeah, he was majoring in anthropology, and he became interested in archaeology, and he hated the field because he didn't like getting dirty, and I was just so annoyed with him.
Oh, that makes it
and
hard.
He finally joined the military. Yeah, he joined the military and, you know, did his thing, and, you know, we followed along, and then we came back to Tucson. It was just the funniest thing. And this is like, you know, 1996 or something. And I get this random phone call, like the day that I get back to Tucson and we go to his parents' house. And it's Jeff, you know, the project director that I knew from way back in the 80s. He said, "Hey, somebody told me you're back in town. Do you want a job?" And I'm all like, "What?" So, yeah, so I went right back out to the field. And then, you know, my husband at that time was not happy. And he was still in Texas trying to get back home because he took a job that he hated and was, you know, on his way back. And me and the kids drove cross country. We came back to stay at his family's house and wait for him to get back. But, you know, I got that job. And his dad was super proud and excited because we both got up early like construction workers and we got, you know, got ready for work. And his dad actually worked for the mine. So he taught me how to pack my lunch so I'm not dehydrated and, you know, what to eat. But anyway, my husband at that time was not happy. He was just livid. I continued to work anyway. And then he encouraged me, well, not encouraged me, but he told me, you know, you don't need to be out there anymore. You need to find a different job. And I'm like, you know, well, I really like what I'm doing. And I actually, I'm thinking about going back to school for it. And the people from one of the jobs I had taken, because I, you know, it's kind of like once you get to know people within these different places with the different contract archaeology groups, you know, you hop on one job and you go to a different one. So I had been on, I think, my third job already. You know, it was just really freaking him out. And he just told me point blank, he said, "You can't go back to college." And I'm all like, "What?" He said, "Yes. Your people cannot comprehend complex, whoa, you know, thought. And you're better off working at the Pancake House or in one of the factories here in town.
Whoa.
And he was not joking. Yeah, he was not joking. And he said, you know, he goes, that's just the way it is. You know, Native peoples don't have that kind of comprehension. And, you know, of course, you know, he's a white guy. And I was pissed. I just, yeah, you know, and I couldn't yell at him. I couldn't do anything because, like I said, he was a bad person and very abusive. So I just thought to myself, okay, I'm out, you know, yeah, because again, you know, I just was like determined not to have my kids come from a broken family, but I'm all like, okay, that's it. That's just, yeah, it. You know, I put up with enough. And so I left. I enrolled at the university and took the same anthropology courses he made me type up on his papers and edit, and aced every one of those classes because I already knew, right, the content.
You'd already taken them, essentially.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, I took them from the same professors he took and complained about and completely thought they were great. And that's what, I guess you would say, inspired me, was just being told that, you know, no, you can't do it. And I could understand, well, we don't have the money, we can't afford it, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But to be told that because of who I am as a Native person, I can't, you know, do that. So when I told you that I took my first AIS class, that's where I learned where he got that from.
Oh.
Because one of the lecturers was on boarding school. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Shanina Loma Waima. She was my very first AIS professor in the trad class. And she did a lecture on boarding schools and actually quoted what the anthropologists were telling, you know, the administrators about the Native girls there, that they couldn't use sewing machines or machinery because their brains were not set up in that way, and that they couldn't comprehend complexity. And you know, and it was so funny. It was just almost verbatim of what he told me, because I can't remember exactly what he said, but that's pretty much the gist of it. So it was just like listening to him say it again. I just sat there in the auditorium like, what the heck, you know?
Yeah.
So that's pretty much what really inspired me, was like, wow, you know, this is what people are learning. If anything, that's what American Indian Studies have really given me, is that understanding of where we are as tribal communities today. And, you know, when it comes to politics and to, I guess, like cultural genocide, you know, we're just pretty much stripped of our traditions and our beliefs. It really became more than just like, oh, I want to be a professor and I want to be a famous archaeologist. No, it's to the point now where, no, you know, this needs to stop. And that's what my dissertation was about, you know, looking at conservation. Because, again, just going into that museum and I'm getting a little emotional here, but, you know, just going into that museum and working there was like being married to that person again. It was very dark, just very backwards. And, you know, being told in different ways on a daily basis, you know, that I didn't really know anything, and, you know, just, you know, that they were the experts of who we are. Mm-hmm. And so it was quite the struggle.
I'm surprised that made you want to continue. After all that, you know, working in the museum, if it was I can totally see how it would be tempting to just be like, I can't do this to myself, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's why I had to get out of there. You know, I had to get out of that place. It was extremely toxic. I mean, I was so happy to be there when I first got the position. I was hired as the like liaison with the travel relations, but my background is specific towards conservation. And that's basically what I wanted to do. But getting my foot in the door and dealing with the tribal relations, that was just, you know, again, more politics. And I was not suited for that. I did my best to reach out to the different Native departments. And yeah, a lot of them, you know, were interested. We'd have like events and programs at the museum. And that was something that I was very much determined to bring to the museum because I knew that our ancestors were being housed there. So having someone do a blessing or singing was just always a good feeling to that place. You know, reaching out to the people who had the power to help me through this was just a complete disaster because, you know, there are these initiatives for diversity and inclusivity and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, they're just a facade. You know, the person who is the person that, you know, is like in the higher administrative place next to the president, you know, being Native herself, being Navajo. And I knew her when we were teenagers. And I would reach out to her and I would tell her, you know, what's going on. And she just, you know, come back and say, well, you know, I went through the same thing. It's just the way it is. And then she just told me that I needed to dress better. I needed to look important. And so she sent me coupons to buy a new outfit, to wear makeup, to wear heels, you know, to look important. And I'm like, why? You know, no. I, you know, first of all, the one time I decided to dress up and go to work at ASM, everybody kept saying, oh, what's going on? What are you, you know, do you have a meeting or do you, are you going somewhere? I'm all like, no, I'm just coming to work dressed up. And because, you know, no one dresses up at ASM unless, you know, we're going to a conference or right. some kind of meeting. I don't know. But yeah, everyone,
it's Tucson.
There's a guy that walks around in sandals and white socks.
Sandals and white socks.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, and I guess, you know, her being an administrator and being in that office, you know, with her dresses and her high heels and her manicured nail and her makeup and, you know, her hair. It's just like, I was not going to do that. So that was really frustrating. And, you know, I every so often I go back and I look at the website and I just want to gag because the students are just, you know, they're so impressionable.
Yeah.
And then they get let down. So, you know, it's, you know, it, that was really frustrating. I did have support though. You know, I had a lot of support with the community, especially with the Global Justice Center down on 6th Avenue or 6th, well, South Tucson. I used to run with the Capoles, the people that do the unity runs. We do these barrio runs throughout town and, you know, bless community members. So that was really where, you know, I stayed strong. And plenty of people kept telling me, you just can't, you know, it's hard, but, you know, just hang in there. I think on a positive note, the person who was actually in that position before me, she moved on to a different department at the university. And she was actually my mentor, and I would just go see her and close the door and shed a few tears. And yeah, so she would really give me some good advice and help me, you know, and tell me what to expect. And so that really got me through. But it's just a shame that nothing had changed from the time that she was there to when I was there. And they did have an advisory board, which is, you know, it's a group, but it's made up of all 21 tribes in Arizona. And each member is from the Cultural Resources Department. So it's not like, you know, a random artist or, you know, whoever. Right. It's actual cultural resource people. Mm-hmm. And so on a positive note, I was able to, you know, really strengthen that group. And, you know, I still know them now. And so now I'm in the same position they are. Again, that's what made my life a living hell with the director there, was that, you know, strengthening the board, and they were given a voice, and that just didn't go over too well. It was really hard on the museum to deal with, you know, the tribes and them, you know, being aware of what was going on there. So, yeah. And now that I'm gone, I don't know if they even replaced me or, you know, they have a position opening for that. I have no idea. I don't know if the board is still running. I haven't looked into that. I haven't even asked. So, knowing that, you know, they are the permitting agency and the agency that mandates the Arizona revised statutes and whatever for the, you know, archaeology companies and whatever, you know, it's like, well, I still have to deal with them. Yeah, I totally agree with you. There are times when I was just like, you know, forget this. I just want to not do this anymore. The only problem I had with that is that I spent so much time and money getting a PhD.
Right.
That just the thought of not utilizing it wasn't like sad for me. It was more the principle. Like, you know, you bought something. It's like, you know, you buy an exercise machine and it just sits in the corner with clothes hanging on it. And, you know, I just felt that it was a waste of my time and a waste of money to go the whole way and, you know, get this degree. I could be doing better things, but I can't let that go to waste. And I'm still paying off my student loans. So, for me, it's the principle. I don't know. You know, I maybe I'm just cheap. Who knows? But that's just, yeah. You know, I just don't like to waste money. And yeah. And it is frustrating.
All right. So we are at our first break point. We will be back here in just a second.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code HEVO, HEVO. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
All right. So we are back from our break and we're just going to dive right back in where we were talking. Yeah. If you were to like give advice to, let's say, a museum or another organization that is trying to like diversify and be more inclusive, it sounds like, from what I'm hearing from you, it's not like that they weren't really like valuing your expertise or listening to the tribes. Is that the advice you would give to other organizations that are, if they're trying to do better?
Yeah, I would just tell them to be honest with themselves. Mm-hmm. Why are they hiring this person? What is your objective? Is it because you have this extra funding that you need to hire a Native person? Or is it because you want to apply for grants, but it would be nice to have, you know, some Native staff so that, you know, that your institution is diverse and inclusive? Because, you know, that makes a huge difference. It's like when you hire, you know, you're hiring somebody. You hire them and you have a great respect for them. Say, you know, you're hiring this archaeologist who's white and you know that they've published and they've done all this stuff. You know, do you take advantage of that person's ethnicity and put them on grants? You know, there's that level of respect. It like you almost become, well, you do. You become a token. I was, you know, I felt like a token. I was put on so many grants. You would not believe it for that museum. I was on so many grants and it just really disgusted me. And, you know, I was just like, wow, you know, so this is what it's about. And I would just, yeah, tell them to really be honest with themselves. And unfortunately, so many of them are not. They hear it in one ear and it goes out the other. And I don't know how long it is going to take, but, you know, their level of ignorance is just, it's just this huge wall that they cannot seem to get past. And it is frustrating. I don't know how many times I had these hallway approval meetings where I'll be walking in the hall and then the education person will say, oh, by the way, Martina, I was thinking of doing this project and blah, blah with these Native students. And what do you think? And I'll be, oh, that's kind of cool. And then I walk off. That's all I would say. That's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. And before you know it, Martina approved the project.
Right.
Had a meeting with Martina. And I'm like, you know, and then I end up getting into screaming matches and hollering, at, you know, and just upset, you know. I know that just seems rude and, you know, very much having these crazy assumptions, but it's like there are so many people that just do not get past, you know, that ethnicity situation where, you know, they just don't hear you. They're just in their own world. And it's really hard. It's like when I told you earlier on that the younger generations have a better outlook. Like they're very mindful and don't really get caught up in like, oh yeah, you know, they're Navajo. They must know how to weave and their mom must be weaving, you know. It's like, you know, everyone is pretty much, you know, whoever they are until someone shares something about themselves. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to explain, but I guess it's maybe just how some people grow up or, and of course, the older generation is just how, you know, they were taught. And it just goes all the way back to anthropology. You know, it just started off with Kroeber, with Malinowski, with Boas, you know, their description of the indigenous people, and then those being put in reports through the boarding schools, through these programs here, and these assumptions that, you know, yes, the native kids need to go back out and get their hands in the dirt, and they need to really, you know, get back into their culture and do this and that. And, you know, those assumptions are very romanticized. Whereas, you know, when you get into a culture, there are things about the culture that are not the romantic part.
Right.
And those things that are not romantic are protocols, are obligations and duty, you know what you're supposed to do, what is expected of you. And, you know, you growing up in your culture, you can understand that, knowing, you know, the prayers, knowing the language, you know, those are not very romantic. Sometimes they just seem so like, oh my God, you know, do I have to do this? But, you know, the romantic part is like the things that you see bought, you know, like weaving the rugs, making the moccasins, you know, dancing, you know, the powwows and stuff like that. That's not, you know, all of who we are. It's a lot more comes with it. So explaining to a museum professional, I guess, again, you know, the first thing is they need to really look at themselves and be honest with themselves as to why they're bringing a Native person into their institution. And most importantly, just know the difference between, the easiest way that I could put it with my experience at ASM is that there were two kinds of indigenous, not people, but kind of indigenous, not really definitions, but just kind of like the way the museum perceives, but then they intertwine them. There's the Indian art Indians, you know, with the turquoise and Santa Fe and, you know, and all of that. And then there's the Native peoples that come from tribal communities that are here today and doing their best to make ends meet, and, you know, and there's ceremony and there's language. It's really serious. And a lot of museum professionals don't really see those differences. They put that together, and then it becomes very convoluted. So all these initiatives about diversity and inclusivity just is from their perspective, from the white the institution's idea of what diversity and inclusivity means, rather than those initiatives being led by Native people, you know, minorities or whoever, you know, it's always initiatives led by these non-Native people.
Right.
And so then they come out very weird. You know, it's like your parents, you know, saying, oh, we're going on a family trip, and everyone's excited to go to Disneyland, but they're like, oh no, we're going to go we're going to go to the farm and everyone's going to milk a cow because it's going to be educational. You know, it's like, because they, you know, the institutions always know better. And they know about natives because, you know, they read about it because Kroeber said, you know, because, you know, all these studies say that. And there was this one native guy that somebody spoke to and interviewed, and this is what they said. And it's like, that was just one native person's perspective. And what I tell the students when I was at the university was always be critical of that one study that has just one or two native peoples that have been interviewed.
Right.
Because you never know, you know, think about it. What if someone wanted to interview your family and they ended up interviewing your crazy uncle and your uncle was just talking all kinds of crazy to these people in the study, you know, and then all of a sudden your family just looks really, you know, everyone's like, oh, wow, you know, that family. You have to really think about that and understand that, you know, we're human too. So, you know, there's not, you know, they're just other people's way of seeing things and understanding. So, yeah. So, you know, just again, back to these museum people, the understanding those differences, and then just again, being very, very truthful with themselves. And, you know, they'll deny it up and down and get mad and, you know, clutch their pearls and go, I've never done that, you know, mm-hmm. I would never. And you're like, oh, but yeah, it's just, yeah. And that, you know, that was really the hardest thing to deal with there. You know, no matter how much you tell them, you realize that it's not really them wanting to know. Again, it's just them wanting to go through the motion to say, yes, we spoke to this community about these objects, and this is what they said. But then they still put it on display after they're told not to do it. And then something happens, and then all of a sudden, you know, there's like angry consultation meetings, and you know, and the museum's just completely freaked out, and the community members are upset, and it's like, oh my God, you know, I told you guys, you know, don't put that out there. And I guess in a nutshell, I really wasn't doing my job correctly at ASM. I guess it took me leaving there and looking at it from the outside as to what I was doing wrong. My job was to be there for the museum and let the tribes know that the museum is doing a good job and that everything's okay and not to worry. And yeah, and that was eye-opening for me. And I don't, you know, regret what I went through to learn, you know, to learn that lesson.
Well, we are at a break point. So when we get back, I definitely want to talk about your work now with Wallapai. So we're going to come back and talk about that here in a second.
Hello, it's Jim Eagle. Please join us for the Bay Area American Indian Two-Spirit Society's 11th Annual Two-Spirit Powwow in person or online this year at San Francisco Fort Mason Center on Saturday, February 12th, 2022. Gore dance at noon and grand entry begins at 1 p.m. There will be over 60 vendors selling all types of indigenous products and crafts. Powwow dancers from all over the U.S. will be competing in contests all day long. We'll also be having several delicious fried bread taco vendors. For more information, go to baits.org. That's BAAITS.org. COVID protocols will be in effect. See you there.
All right. So we are back for our last segment. And I want to hear about your current job, what you're doing for the Wallapai tribe.
Okay. As you had mentioned before, I am the senior archaeologist. So obviously my job is working in that area. And so what I do is read a lot of proposals from different agencies and different companies wanting to develop. And what we do is we actually respond to these different agencies and developers who are not necessarily working or planning to do anything on the reservation, but off the reservation on our ancestral territory. And, you know, tribes in America or in the United States have some standing when it comes to the traditional territories in their area. So currently we're, you know, we're always dealing with a lot, but we have three very significant projects that we are working on. We just learned that, you know, the Snowball is thinking about expanding, Snowball being up in the San Francisco peaks, up in the mountains near Flagstaff. And there, you know, in the past has been controversy with the snowmaking situation, which is a continuous thing. So they're, like I said, they're planning to expand. They do want to develop on the area that they had designated in the past to utilize for recreation. And their first project at hand is to create more snow. And that's, you know, really not a good thing. So that's something that we just got done consulting on, and it seemed to be a pretty good meeting, but we'll find out. Forgot to mention, though, that why are we consulting on the Snowball? And we are doing so because that mountain is actually part of our ancestral territory. So our Hualapai ancestral territory does, you know, it reaches all the way out into that Flagstaff area, the mountains, and then the southern boundary of the Colorado River and the eastern boundary of the Colorado River, which is, you know, the western boundary of Arizona, and then all the way down near Bill Williams River, which is probably around like the Wikiup area. So the other two issues are down in that area. So we're actually working with a couple of situations, one being a lithium mine proposal near one of our properties, one of the Hualapai properties that does contain some traditional cultural places and, you know, property. So that, you know, that's one we're dealing with. I can't really disclose a lot, but, you know, a lot of tribes have to deal with mine. So that's one thing that we're dealing with now. The other one is a mine that's already been established. That's a copper mine. That one I'm actually working on with the elders, and that's dealing with a mining company that had purchased some land. The archaeology company that they contracted had come across some human remains. So we're currently working on their burial agreement, trying to get that straightened out. My job right now is speaking with the elders to get their advice, get some guidance on what we should do with the ancestor that had been uncovered. Fortunately, you know, they didn't completely remove the individual. You know, there is a possibility to keep the burial where it's at and cover it up. So right now we're working in that direction, because that's pretty much what the elders had come together and discussed. And they feel that, you know, that was that person's resting place, and that's where they shall stay. But, you know, again, it's really a combination of working with the agencies and the mining corporation, because that is private property. So we're running into a lot of legal issues that have to do with, you know, private property and what you can and can't do. Again, you know, I don't want to be too forthcoming on everything, but as a tribal archaeologist, my job is not necessarily to go out there and dig around with the other archaeologists. It's to understand what they have done and to respond to a lot of proposals that come in for environmental assessments and, you know, all of that kind of thing, you know. And of course, you know, surveys. I have been working on several surveys here on the reservation, and those are pretty much, you know, they have to do with like power lines and some development areas, home site leases, and it's just, you know, making sure things are clear for cultural resources and making sure that we're utilizing the land properly. Yeah, the tribe's very mindful of that. So that's what I do.
Can you, for those that might not know what that is, could you explain what a home site survey is?
Oh, yeah. And I just got my own home site.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. The cool thing was everything was done before I got there. So I actually took over a lease that somebody gave up and didn't have to go through all the process. So
nice.
I recycled. But anyway, yeah.
Or you could have just done it yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, exactly. So a home site lease is basically a lease agreement between a tribal member and the tribe for a piece of land, a land allotment. And for the Wallapai, we're allowed up to 5 acres of land. And so what happens is you go through a process and you have to go through having the land surveyed by cultural resources, by natural resources, and then by the county surveyors so that they can put that information into their records. And so as a cultural resources service, we go out and we, first of all, we, you know, do our research. We look into our records to make sure that there are no sites in the area. And then we physically go out and then we, you know, map it out and walk the area, do a Class 3 survey, ask questions, get some information from the elders, and just really do a thorough account of, you know, the area. And pretty much, you know, that's it. You know, if we don't come across anything, you know, it's clear. If we do come across anything, then of course, you know, we have to do a little more research in that area. And if it's definitely a site that is found there, then of course you can't build on that area. And basically, yeah, that's what a home site lease is. You know, we lease the land, and for some of you who are familiar with reservation lands and allotments and, you know, property, that's pretty much one of the ways as a tribal member that you are able to kind of like own a piece of land. You know, you're leasing it, but you're not really owning it because the land is held in trust by the U.S. government. So you just go through a whole process to lease the land. So that's what a home site lease is.
Yeah. Okay. And you mentioned the cultural advisory team or the elders that you work with. And I'm currently working with a tribe that's thinking about putting one of those together and what that would look like and how to do it and all of those things. So with that in mind, could you give a little bit of background about how your cultural advisory team works and what you found successful in working with the elders in your community?
Working with the elders has been great, and working with our cultural advisory team has also been great. So there are two different, I wouldn't necessarily say, well, cultural advisory team is definitely a group. And then the elders, we usually go to the elderly center to do presentations. Of course, we, you know, put out flyers and announce it and make sure that as many elders are aware of it to come out. And we just do our best to speak to the elders. But with the advisory team, they're actually brand new. I had learned they were just recently established in 2018. So that's really interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that until I, you know, started reading more about who they were. And working with them has been great. They are a collection of elders and people who work in different departments. they're mostly elders. And so we have people who used to be department directors, council members, knowledge keepers. It's very formal. So if there's any kind of development on the land, if there are any issues, what we're dealing with the mines and with Snowball, we do speak with them, and they provide their perspective and their guidance. And so we usually take in, not really take in consideration, but actually listen and we we're able to make decisions when it comes to, how we're going to respond to a letter or, what we're going to do. So for example, with the mining company that, where the ancestral remains were disturbed, they've been very helpful and very intuitive, not only from a traditional standpoint, but from a very legal and straightforward, no-nonsense standpoint. So it's kind of good, because you get these really intelligent older people who are like pretty much validating that, this is wrong. And then they tell you, yes, it's wrong. And this is what we need to do. It's been very helpful. And I really enjoy working with them. They're just so knowledgeable. I've been away for so long. So actually just taking the time to relearn about my community and get to know who's who, it's just, it's great. And I think the coolest thing is one of the advisory team members was the cultural resources director. And she goes all the way back to the beginning of NAGPRA, to the beginning of, a lot of what is going on now. And, she was the very first TIPO for Hualapai. She was one of the very first TIPOs in the United States. And yeah, so she has a lot of knowledge. And as I get to know more and more of the elders, it's amazing, what they did when they were younger. So I think it's great.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm not sure I've heard a tribe doing it quite like that, with the mix of like elders and really like extra culturally knowledgeable people, and then also having the people with the like political experience or cultural resources experience, and having that combination of the two on an advisory group. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's super cool. Then for a lot of them, you don't have to explain anything because mm-hmm. they're on top of it.
Yeah.
And some of the younger people, my first elder meeting a couple of weeks ago to talk about the ancestor, mm-hmm. it was great. I got so much input, so many great questions from the elders. And then there was this young woman who was there with her grandparent. And I noticed that she had a little notepad and she was taking notes. And then she just like lit up the room. And apparently this is what she's going to school for.
Oh, so cool.
She had so much to say. Yeah, she was very vocal. And I was just holding myself back from being so like, oh, that's so awesome. Trying to maintain my professionality, but I was just like so taken aback and very, very impressed that, there is someone in the community who's very knowledgeable about the laws, about NAGPRA and NEPA and everything, So, yep.
That is awesome.
She just spoke fluently about the laws and all I could do is agree with her and say, you are exactly right. yeah, it was awesome because her grandmother was just sitting next to her beaming, very proud of her. Yeah, so I was just very, very happy. Yeah, and I'm all like, yes, our next director.
Yeah, I was going to say, tell her to put in for a Living Heritage Research Council internship when she gets to that point in school.
Oh,
We're offering paid internships for Indigenous students. Well, not just students. It could be community members, whatever, through the nonprofit that I work with. So tell her to keep an eye out for it.
I will let her know.
Yes.
Yeah. Awesome. But yeah, no, it's just a whole different ball game. You know, on the agency side, being at ASM, you know, it just was so like, there was a whole different, like, you know, you would think that the tribes were clueless and they didn't know anything. And you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And yeah. It just was like, and I didn't know. And I was just like, okay, you know, and that there was this idea of like, well, this is how you have to approach it. Make sure you bring food and tobacco and blah. And then I get here and everybody is just a force. Like a force to be reckoned with when it comes to law. And I'm all like, oh, yeah. Okay. You know? Yeah.
That's and awesome.
They all can pretty much recite the tribal constitution. They, yeah, everybody knows their rights. And I'm all like, And it's, so it's quite impressive and actually extremely empowering. And I hate to admit it, you know, I came in here being all like, oh, I got to come and help the tribe. Shoot, they're helping me, giving me more of an education and actually, you know, empowering me to speak up. Although my boss, Peter, you know, his name is Peter Bungart, you know, he's not Native. And there are times when I was getting a little weary, but then I had to keep repeating to myself, I'm not at ASM. I'm not at ASM. And he is like super, super nice. He's just like really cool and really laid back. So, you know, and I don't know how else to say it. You know, it's just, it's different.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you want to make sure that our listeners hear about your current position before we end out the show?
I mean, it is like, you know, even though my title says senior archaeologist, it's like you do everything. You just don't do one thing. And, you know, that's what I was told when I first, you know, came into this position or during my interview was, you know, we know that, you know, this is what you're going to do, but just be prepared because there are other things you will be doing.
Right.
You know, I was in a parade, you know, I'm actually helping the Veterans Memorial Services this weekend. I did the veterans exhibit last year. I helped them do that. You know, I am now coordinating our La Paz run in remembrance of our ancestors who were marched off to a fort, Fort La Paz. So, you know, there's just a lot that you do. You know, one minute I'm writing these response letters or I'm out in the field. And then the next minute I'm down in the large conference room with the language teachers who are pretty much, some of them are elders, teaching them how to use their laptops. So it's everything. And I love it. I really do love it. And, you know, everyone's so appreciative and no one's in a big hurry. And that's not a bad thing. My first several months, I was like rushing and getting things done so fast and trying to do this and hurry up. And they're like, Martina, calm down, slow down. And it's been very nice.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing with us. And yeah, I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, well, hopefully I made sense. Just kidding.
Oh, you made so much sense. And I'm so excited for everyone to get to have more of an understanding of what the daily life of a tribal archaeologist is like.
Yeah, it's actually quite cool. And and I just love it when someone, you know, tries to poke at me and say, so what did you dig up today? I'm all like, nope, I don't dig up anything. And then, you know, explaining to them and them listening, and they're like, oh, so. Yeah, no, it's actually quite refreshing. And I think it takes some of the agencies and the archaeologists from the outside. It kind of, you know, they're like, oh, she's Native and she's an archaeologist and she's not afraid of human remains. And, you know, and it's like, no, you know, someone has to be there to help take care of our ancestors. You know, that's one thing I felt good about at ASM was I was there and my mom was always there to help me through it and to make sure that our ancestors are being taken care of. And that's why I stay. I can tell you a creepy story. This will be really quick.
Okay.
Yeah. So way back in the day when I first started working at Canyon de Chelly as a park ranger, you know, my mom told me that when I go into the canyon, you know, we had our cultural resources day, our natural resources day, where you can get onto the quad and you go up the canyon and pick up trash. And then you go and look at some of the sites just to check on them. And so I told my mom about that. And she says, well, don't go inside. Don't go inside those ruins. You stay out of there. And of course, you know, me, who's not really, you know, I was like about 23, 22. I kind of started looking into the sites and walking up really close and just really looking at everything. So one night I was asleep and I had this really bizarre dream. And I just, you know, dreamt that I was flying through the canyon, like, you know, just going through the walls and through the canyon. And then I woke up and then that whole day, I could just smell like something had died. Like, you know, it was like a dead body or something just dead and smelly. Mm. And I asked my parents, I said, do you smell that? They're like, what? No one could smell what I was smelling and it was really strong. And then later that evening, my mom said, you went into those ruins, did you? And I said, yeah. She goes, that's why you're smelling that. And I said, yeah, I said, I had a dream that I was, you know, flying through the canyon. And she says, well, they're trying to talk to you. And you just tell them that you're not there to harm anyone and that you're sorry when you go to sleep tonight and they come back. And I'm like, okay. So go to sleep. And I'm just sleeping. And then all of a sudden I'm flying through the canyon again and just going. And then all of a sudden, the canyon turned into these brown boxes on shelves, like in a repository.
Uh-huh.
But see, I wasn't an archaeologist and I had never been in a repository at the time.
Oh, funny.
And yeah. I was flying and going through in it. Yeah. And then I woke up and then the smell was gone. And then, you know, I didn't think about it for years until I finally got hired. Are not hired, but my internship to work at ASM. And I walked into the repository and I saw those brown boxes and I saw those shells. And I was like, holy cow, what the heck? You know, it's like, I don't know what that meant, but I think that's why I stay and keep doing what I'm doing. Yeah, I think the ancestors were telling me that they want to go home.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that really just, you know, hurts my heart. And I think about, you know, this young girl who came to the museum and she blessed it with a basket song in autumn. And her voice just, you know, was just all over the place. You know, because I was there every day, all the time. And I just could feel that the ancestors were very happy. And, you know, I just feel very protective. And, yeah. And they want to come home. And they just don't understand, you know, why are we in these boxes? You know, why are they taking us? What are they trying to learn? And, you know, what are they looking for? Got to keep on keeping on.
Yeah. 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 I was going to say, it's a good thing that they have you working towards getting them home.
Yeah. If not me, then somebody else in the future.
Yes. You know? Yes.
Yeah. And I see it, you know, I've met I met a lot of museum and anthropology and archaeology professionals who are Native, and they're doing it. You know, we're all doing it. And I think that's what really keeps me going, is that I'm not the only one. I'm one of many, and they're doing it. And they, you know, we've been doing it forever. And, you know, before NAGPRA came along, people were fighting for the ancestors to come home. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not a new thing.
Right.
And just meeting Alaska Natives who can tell stories about their ancestors and the ancestors that Boaz, you know, took to the field museum mm-hmm. and got them back. You know, that's just like a trip. You know, you just think about it and you're like, whoa, you know, they knew that that was their grandfather's grandfather or grandparent. You know, you can really trace it back. And when you look at the genealogy, it you know, it doesn't go that far back. And it just seems like yesterday. So anyway, I can keep going on, but I'm going to stop and go to my happy place. And I got to go to town and buy some nuts and bolts for my hoopty.
Yeah. I gotta make some dinner. But thank you so much again for coming on the show and sharing with all of us.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to me. Carry on.
I love it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.